Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And we continue our December history series with Harvard history professor Henry Louis Gates. His stunning new book of text and historical illustrations, Life Upon These Shores, Looking at African American History. Hi, Professor Gates. Thanks again for doing this with us. I continue to learn and learn as I read your book.
Hey, thank you, Brian. How you doing?
I'm doing great. And hopefully we're going to get you on a good line here. Let's see. All right. As I'm asking you the first question, you're going to have to intuit it, because we're going to call you back on your other line. And I'll just tell all of you that as we continue chronologically, today we enter the 20th century. Oh, I'll also tell you that on that gift guide that I just mentioned, I mentioned this Henry Louis Gates book because I really do love it. And though it's kind of a review book format, and it got criticized a little bit for that in a Times review, there's just so much in here to learn from, I think, no matter who you are, unless you're another history professor. And it's also beautiful with all the illustrations. But Professor Gates, you back?
I'm still here on the same line. Thank you, Brian, for those kind words.
And as we continue chronologically, today we enter the 20th century, and I have a person, a place, and a thing on my mind from reading the book. The person is Booker T. Washington. The place is Tuskegee, Alabama. And the thing is war. And let's start with war. The official end of the Iraq War for the United States yesterday was in my mind as I was reading your section on World War I last night. And I realized that throughout the book, you recount how black leaders support the U.S. government war policies, often as a means to equality, including the colonialist Spanish-American War in 1898, which we mentioned last week, and then again in the two world wars. Does something tie all these together?
Yes, the it's the notion that African Americans had to earn the right, prove the right, that they were worthy of citizenship and worthy of equal rights. And one thought, really going back to the American Revolution, Brian, was that the best way was through military service, was through loyalty to the ideals upon which America was founded, even if those ideals weren't being lived up to. And that certainly manifested itself in World War II through the Double V campaign.
What did black leaders care about dying to save Europe for, or making the world safe for democracy, as Woodrow Wilson put it, when they didn't have democracy at home? How are African American leaders able to drum up any enthusiasm for this?
Well, it was very controversial, and that controversy manifested itself first in World War I, when W.E.B. Du Bois wrote an essay, a famous essay called Closed Ranks, saying that in spite of the policies of Woodrow Wilson, who reinstituted segregation in the government under his administration, and you recall, actually aired Birth of a Nation in 1915 at the White House. I mean, Woodrow Wilson was not going to get the Spin Guard Medal from the NAACP.
The famously racist D.W. Griffith movie.
Yes, that's right. And he said it was so accurate, it was history writ with lightning. And, of course, it was not accurate about Reconstruction at all. But Du Bois called for black people to put aside their problems with Wilson and America, and just remember, lynching was still prominent then, and close ranks. That was the name of his essay. And that was the same attitude that manifested itself in World War II, but with a twist, and it's called the Double V campaign. And the Double V campaign stood for democracy, victory at home and victory abroad. And it was launched by the Pittsburgh Courier, which is one of the great black newspapers. And it was launched in 1942. And they even printed up a Double V logo that was in the Pittsburgh Courier. It was on sheet music. Everybody was talking about it. The goal was to fight fascism abroad, but simultaneously fight racism at home, and through noble black service, show that our ancestors were worthy of being full citizens. And, you know, ironically, though it was quite difficult, and there were many bumps along the way, the theory actually worked out. It took a long time to play itself out. And, you know, most people don't realize that, and I know I'm sure you'll want to talk about the Tuskegee Airmen in a minute, but most people don't realize that even as the war was raging, race riots broke out in the United States. In the summer of 1943, there were four distinct race riots, two in the South, one in Alabama in May of 1943. Another one in Beaumont, Texas, involving a white woman who claimed to have been raped by a black man in June. But then the biggest one was June 20th, 1943, in Detroit. And over a period of 2 days, 25 black people and 9 white people were dead. And then a month later, riots broke out in Harlem over the arrest of a black man and untrue rumors that he'd been killed by the police. And that left 6 men dead. And that riot has famously been memorialized by the great Ralph Ellison in his novel, Invisible Man. But in spite of that, black men were fighting abroad. And one of the things that pains me most is that the service of black military men has not been adequately recognized by Hollywood. You know, I think that only the work of Spike Lee. Did you ever see The Miracle of Santa Ana?
No.
Well, it was Spike's film. I love this film. But only that focuses on black soldiers in Europe. And the Ben Affleck version of Pearl Harbor has a memorable appearance by Cuba Gooding Williams playing the seaman Dory Miller, who played a key role in the he was a mess man at Pearl Harbor. And when the man arming the cannon, the artillery, was killed, he took over and shot down several invading, four, as a matter of fact, Japanese planes, and he was honored for it. But if you think about the most iconic movies about World War II, The Longest Day, right, or Saving Private Ryan, or Band of Brothers, they all ignore the black participation in the Normandy landing.
It's a great point. And to the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II, on the day of President Obama's inauguration, we had an interview that I did with a Tuskegee Airman from the Bronx who got to attend the inauguration. You may know him, Roscoe Brown, President Emeritus of Bronx Community College.
Yeah, and I don't know him, but I admire him.
I thought on this occasion we might play a few seconds of that.
The fact that we did what we did in such an outstanding way, not losing German bombers that we were escorting, shooting down the first jets, blowing up a destroyer, and being so really, really good in the air, it eliminated that myth that said blacks didn't have the courage or coordination to do technical things. And as a result, given the careers of many Tuskegee Airmen after the service, Percy Sutton, who you know became Bronx president, founded Inner City Broadcasting Company. Lee Archer, Vice President of General Foods. Coleman Young, the mayor of Detroit. All of those were Tuskegee Airmen. So we feel it is a fulfillment of what we were struggling for.
So Roscoe Brown on the day of President Obama's inauguration. And now to close the loop, Professor Gates, we have the Iraq War ending with blacks and Latinos serving disproportionately, as the narrative has changed from being allowed to fight equally and being recognized for your participation to an economic draft that brings people of color in disproportionately. Congressman Charles Rangel, a Korean War veteran, wants to bring back the draft partly for that reason.
Yeah, well, I know that Charles wants to do that, but I don't think that that's going to happen. Do you see that on?
No, I don't think it's going to happen. But I'm just talking about the narrative arc of black history and how different things are.
Well, you're absolutely right. And do you know that when, at the beginning of the war, when World War II, when black men went in, they were all confined by and large to quartermaster camp. Ironically, my father, and you know, we talked about how this book is really my father's book. When he was drafted, he went to Camp Lee, Virginia, which is in Petersburg, Virginia. My mentor at Yale when I was an undergraduate was Charles C. Davis, who had just graduated from Dartmouth. He was a black man. He went in as second lieutenant, and they were at the same quartermaster camp. My father had just graduated from high school. Charles Davis had graduated from Dartmouth and then had a master's degree in Chicago, and both of them were at quartermaster camp at exactly the same place. And, of course, that slowly began to change. And one of the things that biggest surprises to me about the Tuskegee Airmen is that two women, ironically, were more responsible, I think, for the creation of the Tuskegee Airmen program than anyone, and often their roles are unheralded. And I'm speaking, of course, of Mary McLeod Bethune and her best friend, dear friend, Eleanor Roosevelt. And here's an interesting story. Bethune served in the Roosevelt administration, in the National Youth Administration, in the Office of Minority Affairs. And one of the clever things that she did was that she insisted and she lobbied for the participation of black people in a program called the Civilian Pilot Training Program, which functioned in America between 1938 and 1944. And it was, you know, it was all around the country, and it was training people to be pilots eventually to serve in the war. And by getting black people the right to train, they were able to build up a cohort that eventually became the Tuskegee Airmen. And then, Brian, she persuaded Eleanor Roosevelt to go to Tuskegee, to the famous Moton Field, and to take a flight piloted by a black flight instructor named Charles Anderson. And nobody wanted her to do this. The Secret Service, they all thought it was dangerous. Could a Negro fly a plane? Eleanor Roosevelt said, I'm going to do it. And because of that, they created, in July 1941, right after that flight, the Tuskegee Airmen. And as you know, 962 black pilots went through that system, and 450 of them flew in combat. And the most famous was the 332nd, because they were 8 squadrons, and typical Brotherswood style, they painted their P-51 Mustangs with bright red tails so that everybody could see them.
For camouflage.
You got it. But, you know, in the tape that you played, it was very moving, but I don't want people to get the wrong idea. 66 airmen did die during the war, and others earned Purple Hearts and Silver Stars and Distinguished Flying Crosses. But you know something, Brian? Mm-hmm. Think about the Medal of Honor, right? 25 African-Americans earned the Medal of Honor during the Civil War, the American Civil War. 18 earned the Medal of Honor during the Indian Wars, you know, the Buffalo Soldiers. 6 African-Americans earned the Medal of Honor during the Spanish-American War. A man named Freddie Stowers was the only African-American to win the Medal of Honor in World War I. Guess how many won the Medal of Honor in World War II?
Don't know.
Take a wild guess. A wild guess.
Zero.
Zero. Zero. And that did not change until 1992. When a study, which was conducted by Shaw University and commissioned by the Department of the Defense, asserted that systematic racial discrimination had been present in the criteria for awarding the medals. And so they converted under Bill Clinton in 1997, 50 years after the end of the war, Bill Clinton converted 7 of these Distinguished Service Crosses to African Americans as the Medal of Honor. And that just shows you that in spite of – this is a long-winded way of answering your question about the relationship between race and military service and citizenship. But even though black men were distinguishing themselves in the war, there still was this systematic discrimination going on in terms of who was being honored and who not. There were 500 black soldiers who landed at Normandy on June 10th. 1944, but you never see them in any of those movies.
We just have about a half a minute left, and it was so interesting to spend this time talking about the arc of history with respect to war that we're not going to get today to the other Tuskegee piece of history, the horror of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, and Booker T. Washington, who happened to hail from Tuskegee, Alabama as well. But just take really in 20 seconds, I'm going to have to cut you off. But when did the Tuskegee Airmen story get out? It's pretty well known in America today. When did it really break out?
You mean when did it become public?
Correct. Really popular.
Well, it was the black newspapers reported it like crazy. But it wasn't until the Black Studies movement in the late 1960s.
And that has to be the last word. Henry Louis Gates will continue with us for two more weeks with his December series on Life Upon These Shores, looking at African-American history. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.